And it will be helpful to keep that passage open in front of you now as we look at these 12 verses under the title, Three Misunderstandings About Christianity. Three Misunderstandings About Christianity. Now, some misunderstandings can be quite amusing. And before the days of internet and email, they used to occur quite frequently in newspaper sports reports. The reporter at the sports event would write down his story and then he would phone it through to headquarters. And sometimes this would result in quite funny things making it into the paper. In the year 2000, in the Open Golf Championship at St Andrews, a copy taker wrote down the phrase, missed a putt, which is a golfing term, as Mr. Putt. And another, my favourite story of a sporting misunderstanding apparently happened when Wales were playing Latvia in football. And in that case, the misunderstanding had the Welsh attack being led not by Rush and Hughes, who were two strikers at the time, but by Russian Jews. But sometimes misunderstandings can be more of an inconvenience. Maybe you arrange to meet someone for lunch and they go to the wrong cafe and you end up wasting an hour. But sometimes misunderstandings can be serious or even deadly. Maybe it occurs in a hospital and there's a mix-up as to how much of a certain drug that someone should be given. And they're given the wrong amount and it can have serious consequences. And in James chapter 4, we're looking at three misunderstandings that can have serious consequences. Because James here is dealing with problems in the church that he's writing to. And these problems were the result of three misunderstandings. Misunderstandings about what Christianity actually is. And these three misunderstandings are still very common today, both inside the church, among people like whom James was writing to, and also among those outside the church, maybe among your friends and family. These are things, misunderstandings they might have about Christianity too. And these misunderstandings, they're all very easy to pick up, both for us and for others. And even if we know better, it's easy to fall back into these ways of thinking. So James flags up each of these three important areas, and he says, don't misunderstand. And the first area where these Christians have misunderstood is in verses 1 to 3, where James reminds them that Christianity is about more than surface change. Christianity is about more than surface change. So that's our first misunderstanding, and we'll be spending most time in this and then less time on the second and third one. So Christianity is about more than surface change. Have you ever sat and pulled the heads off dandelions? Or maybe you've watched kids do it. And if you went back to the same spot a year later, would you be surprised if dandelions were still growing? Would you say, but I pulled the heads off them, how can they still be here? Well, you wouldn't be surprised that they've grown back, because you'd know that nothing had been done to the roots. And James's concern in verses 1 and 2 here is that we would look for the sin behind the sin. Look for the sin behind the sin. And he's talking here about the roots. He's saying that going round trying to stop the different outward sins, and sins being the wrong things in our lives, is just like running around trying to pull the heads off dandelions. Yes, it might appear to work in the short term, but the root is still there, and that's what really needs to be dealt with. James is writing here to a church which is apparently being divided by fights and quarrels. And in verse 1, he asks the question, what causes the fights and quarrels among you? But as he's asking everyone in general here, we can tell that he's not expecting them to say, well, she said this to me, or he did this to me. No, James is looking not for the apparent surface cause, but the deeper underlying cause behind these fights and quarrels. It would be perhaps like an aeroplane crash investigation. The immediate cause of the crash might be poor weather, but really the underlying crash was that the navigation system wasn't designed to cope with extreme weather conditions. So in verse 1 here, rather than focusing on the outward fights and quarrels that were disrupting the church, James says to them that, well, actually, your main problem is the inward battles that are being fought in your hearts. He says that fights and quarrels come not primarily because someone provokes you or does something to you, but because that there are inward desires battling it out in your heart. And if you think about it, we can sometimes be quick to blame outward factors for the way we react, when really it's a result of our inward desires. Have you ever been in a traffic jam and you're getting more and more frustrated and anxious? Maybe you start pounding the steering wheel or waving your arms about or whatever you do. And then you turn and you see the person in the car in the lane beside you, and they're singing along to the radio or they're chatting away to the person beside them. They're facing the exact same circumstances as you, but they're reacting completely differently. What's the difference? James would say that the problem is the desires inside you. You're getting frustrated because at that moment, a wrong desire is winning the battle to control you. Maybe it's the desire not to look bad by being late for a meeting. And that's really just a form of pride at the end of the day. The word that James uses for desire here is always used negatively. It's used to describe sinful, self-indulgent desires. But maybe this desire starts off as something that's okay in and of itself. Like the person in the traffic jam having the desire to get home and relax. But just like in actual wars, these heart battles are fought for control of a territory, for control of an area. And if your desire to get home wins the battle for control of your heart, it's as if you close your hand around it, and then you'll react negatively to anything that gets in the way of this ruling desire of your heart. Whether that's a traffic jam, whether it's when you get home your kids need you to do stuff for them, then you're going to react in anger and frustration. And that, the anger and frustration might be the surface problem, but the underlying deeper problem is that you want to relax, you want to do what you want. And so going to classes on anger management isn't going to get to the root of the problem, because really it's your selfishness at the bottom. The sin below the sin is the sin of selfishness that says that you have a right to get home and relax and won't allow anyone or anything to stand in the way of that. And similarly, in verse 2, James pinpoints the causes of fights and quarrels in the church that he's writing to. It's not the fault of other people provoking them. It's not even that they're argumentative or quarrelsome people. Those are only the surface problems. They're only the dorsal fin of the shark that we can see above the surface. Below the surface is a real problem. And that is a problem of coveting. He says it in verse 2. Just like Ahab in the passage we read earlier, they have a sinful desire to have something that somebody else has. And the actual fighting and quarrelling is only the result of not being able to get what they covet. And coveting is just another example here. Maybe you're someone who's constantly anxious and irritable when anybody does something that might possibly mess up your house. And you're trying to deal with your anxiety and the fact that you're easily irritated. But perhaps as you look for the sin below the sin, you realise that actually the irritable anxiety is just the dorsal fin that's sticking up below the, above the surface. And for you, perhaps the real issue is pride. You want people to think well of you, so you want your house to be super neat and tidy. But the deeper problem is that you want people to think well of you. And so the deeper problem is pride. And these are just examples, but for many things in our lives, sins we struggle with, look below the surface and see, by God's help, what is really the issue. My home church in Derry used to have what's called a Virginia creeper growing on the outside walls. It was a creeping plant, and it looked like ivy. But recently it all had to be stripped off because it was starting to get into the foundations and it would have caused structural problems if nothing had been done. And there would have been no point just stripping it off if the roots hadn't been dealt with, or would it just have grown back? But so often in our lives we see things that we want to change. Maybe you've even tried to change things in your life. Perhaps you see frustration and bitterness creeping into a relationship and you think, I've had enough of this, I want to stop it. Or maybe it's an obsessive perfectionism or a struggle with addictions and you try and scrape away the creepers but you don't do anything about the roots. Yet you're surprised when it keeps coming back. James says, don't waste your energy running around pulling the heads off dandelions. Go for the roots. So Christianity is about more than surface change, because it's about dealing with the sin behind the sin. But in verse 3, James goes at this from a different angle, and he shows that Christianity is about more than surface change, because we should look for the sin even behind good things. If Christianity was just about surface change, then all we would have to do is swap the bad things in our life for good things. But here James reminds us in verse 3 that even the good things we do are affected by sin. Sin isn't just the bad things that we do, but even includes the motives behind the good things we do. In verse 3, James is speaking here to people who are praying to God, and they're asking him for things. But they're not getting because they're asking with wrong motives. Even though they're doing something good, James says that it's still affected by sin. Just because you're praying instead of fighting doesn't necessarily mean that you're not sinning. The people that James is writing to have asked God to give them things, but only so that they could spend them on their passions or pleasures. They're praying like John Ward, who was a member of the British Parliament in the 1800s. When he died, the following prayer was found written out among his papers. And apparently his prayer went like this. O Lord, thou knowest that I have mine estate in the city of London, and likewise that I have lately purchased an estate in the county of Essex. I beseech thee to preserve the two counties of Middlesex and Essex from fire and earthquake, and as I have a mortgage in Hertfordshire, I beg of thee likewise to have an eye of compassion on that county. As for the rest of the counties, thou mayest deal with them as thou pleasest. And we may smile at such a prayer, but could it be that ours aren't much different at times? Yes, they might not sound as blatantly self-serving, but are our motives much different? Are your prayers basically asking God to take your side? Or are they asking that in whatever situation you're in, that he would make you more and more like Jesus? Have you fallen into the trap of thinking of God as some sort of divine waiter, whose job is to bring you whatever you order off the menu, even if he knows that it's going to be really bad for you? These people that James was writing to were Christians. They were praying to God. They would have seemed very religious, very serious, very pious people. But even their religious actions were tainted by sin. And even our outwardly good religious actions suffer from mixed motives at best. James shows our deep need for change at root level. But the hope of Christianity isn't that we can do it ourselves. The hope of Christianity is a person. Not just any person, but the one person who ever lived who had no outward sin and no inward sin. Even as a child, no one could have said to him, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Because there weren't any. The Bible tells us that he travelled about for 3 years with 12 very frustrating disciples, but he didn't lose the rag with them. And in all his prayers, and in all his good deeds, he'd completely pure motives. His name is Jesus, and he is our only hope. So James reminds his readers that Christianity is about more than surface change. And secondly, we see the reminder in verses 4 to 6 that Christianity is a relationship. Christianity is a relationship. Because another common misunderstanding about Christianity, inside the church and outside it, is that it's about doing certain things, going through various outward forms, rituals, and basically trying to live on the straight and narrow. But if that's how we think of it, we'll not understand the language of verses 4 and 5. This is the language of adultery. James here wants to raise the stakes, so his readers see their compromising conduct for what it really is. It's not that the people were committing actual sexual sin, but the Bible describes the relationship between Jesus and his people as a marriage. Jesus is the husband, and his people are the bride. And marriage is a brilliant picture of our relationship with God in so many ways. For a start, you can't be half married. It's all or nothing, or so I'm led to believe. You're either a Christian or not, in the same way as you're either married or not. There's no halfway house. On the 10th of July, God willing, I'll walk into a church building in Scotland 100% unmarried and walk out 100% married. And that's a great picture of the difference between Christianity and religion. Because with religion, you have to try all your life to live up to certain standards. And at the end, if you've been good enough, you, hopefully God will accept you. But Christianity is like a marriage. It's a loving relationship. But it's also a legal standing, as the Bible describes it. The second before a person is married, they've absolutely no part of this legal standing. But the second after they're married, they have it all. And that's you if you're a Christian. You have it all. Your legal status before God has been completely changed. You don't have to wait to find out. You don't have to wait to experience God's blessing. You have it now. But the fact that we're called to such a glorious relationship is a real problem for us. Because from birth, we find ourselves in relationship not with God, but with the world. And even as Christians, we tend to wander. But marriage is to be a commitment to be faithful. That's why James uses the language of adultery in verse 4. These people were being unfaithful. Rather than loving Jesus as a devoted wife loves her husband, they were getting involved in a deep, close, intimate friendship with the world. And by using the word world, James just means human society apart from God. Life lived without reference to God. These people weren't necessarily doing the things, or at least everything that the unbelievers around them were doing. But they were leaving God out of their lives. And as a result of that, they were starting to look more and more like those around them. No matter how much they might have claimed to love Jesus and be faithful to him, there was clear evidence in their lives that they hadn't been. If a private detective had been hired to find out if there was adultery going on, it wouldn't have taken much time to find out. The fights and quarrels in verse 1 were just evidence that they were taking on the world's ways of thinking. And we've seen much of this evidence over the past few weeks. Worldly wisdom, evil tongues, showing favoritism, talking the talk but not walking the walk. It's clear as day, says James, that you've been in bed with the world. They were being unfaithful. And if our biggest problem is that we're in relationship with the world, our biggest need is to be in relationship with Jesus. If you haven't trusted Jesus before, you need to enter this relationship. Going to church, going through certain outward forms, trying to clean up your life, or being a good person won't make you right with God. You need Jesus. You need this relationship. You need him to deal with the deep underlying sins in your life as well as the more obvious ones. And you also need him to cleanse you of your religious attempts to please him. If you started this relationship but are starting to wander, James calls you back to it. Because a faithful relationship with Jesus is your greatest need too. How does God react to his people being unfaithful? The answer is in verse 5. Apparently it's one of the hardest verses in the New Testament to translate. But the right sense is probably along the lines that's given in the NIV footnote. And basically it's saying that God reacts with jealousy. He has put his Holy Spirit inside us. And he's not just going to accept us being unfaithful. It grieves him. It's something that he's not just going to ignore. Maybe you read that and you're wondering, is it okay for God to be jealous? Because after all, when we think about jealousy, it's almost always wrong. But again, it helps to think of it in terms of a marriage. What would you think of a husband who was happy for his wife to stay over with other men? Well, you wouldn't think that he loved her. There's a good, healthy sense in which a husband should be jealous for the attentions of his wife uniquely, and vice versa. True love is always jealous. It always has a proper intolerance of straying affection. Remember that James is writing to Christians. And so is there anything in your life that would make God righteously jealous? Is there anything that could be drawing your affections away from Jesus? Are there any ways in which you're straying from the most important relationship of all? Is your love growing cold? Verse 4 reminds you that you can't have it both ways. Anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. So Christianity is a relationship. Our problem is that we're in relationship with the world. Our greatest need is a relationship with Jesus. But maybe that raises a couple of questions. How can I start such a relationship? Or how can I stay faithful when there are so many temptations to stray? James's answer to both those questions is that it's all about grace. It's all about grace. The first six words of verse 6 could be easy to skip over, but in fact they're one of the brightest parts of the whole letter of James. In the face of our own natural tendency to wander, and in the face of all the attractions of the world, how can we have any hope of starting and staying in this relationship? But he gives us more grace. Of ourselves, we aren't able, but in his grace, Jesus gives us what we don't have. His grace makes us able to stay faithful. By ourselves we can't do it, but he gives us more grace. And again, it's only because of what Jesus has done. In the Old Testament, God told the prophet Hosea to go and marry an adulterous woman who would be unfaithful to him. It was to be a shocking picture of what God's people were doing to God. But Hosea wasn't to give up on this wife. Instead, he was to keep loving her. He was to be a picture of how Jesus wouldn't give up on us. The one who was perfectly faithful in every way died so that we, the unfaithful, could be loved with an everlasting and unchanging love. Christianity is a relationship. And then thirdly and finally, we see Christianity is about being taken down before you're lifted up. Christianity is about being taken down before you're lifted up. We see this in the rest of verse 6 through to verse 12. The third misunderstanding that James corrects is how we can experience this grace. We've seen that it's only by God's grace that we can start and stay in such a wonderful relationship. But how do we start it? And once we do, what does this grace-filled life actually look like? What should people who've experienced such love look like on a day-to-day basis? Well, the world would probably expect that if we wanted to begin a relationship with such a king, then we would need to promote ourselves. And if we truly are in a relationship with a king like Jesus, like the Bible says Jesus is, then we would live as if we've arrived. We would strut around proud that we've made it. Have you ever told anyone that you're 100% certain of going to heaven? How did they react? Well, they probably said that you're being arrogant. But in fact, James calls us to live lives of humility. In verse 6, he quotes a proverb from the Old Testament. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. In verse 10, he calls on his readers to humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up. And verses 6 and 10 are like two bookends. And in between these two bookends, we see ways in which we can humble ourselves before God. And if you're not yet a Christian, this is the first step. You need to humble yourself before God. You need to see that your life doesn't just have undesirable things on the surface that you can maybe clean up, but that those are only the results of deeper underlying sin. And you need to submit to God's authority in verse 7. Then verse 9 says, grieve, mourn and wail. Change your laughter to mourning and your joy to gloom. It's not saying that to become a Christian you have to become a miserable person. But you do need to grieve and mourn for your sin. If you're to experience the true joy that Jesus brings, you need to give up seeking superficial joy and empty laughter. In verse 8, you need to see that your hands need washed and your heart needs purified. The stain of your wrong thoughts, motives and actions needs cleansed, and only Jesus can do it. And if you do this, then it will show that Jesus has been working in your life. And if he's given you the grace to humble yourself, he will also exalt you. He will exalt you by lifting you up and making you a part of his family, with God as your father and Jesus as your older brother. You'll be part of the greatest, most loving, most significant relationship that there is. The one relationship which lasts for eternity. But what if you're a Christian already? Does that mean that you've arrived? Does that mean that you can think that you're something? Does it mean that you're better than other people, whether they're not Christians or whether they're Christians but perhaps they don't know as you, don't know as much as you, as much of the Bible? Well, the road that you're now walking along or driving along as Christians is the same. It's made of the same stuff as a slip road by which you come onto it. All these things still apply. You still need God's grace each day. And so you still need to humbly seek it each day. In verse 7, you're still to submit to God. You're to keep looking at each area of your life and asking, have I placed this area under Jesus' rule? And when you face temptation, what a promise in the second part of the verse. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Not because you're something, but because Jesus is standing beside you. Verse 8 is yet another call from James in this letter for us to be complete Christians. Don't be double-minded. Don't just cleanse your hands, the outward things, but purify your hearts. Don't just focus on the outward behaviour, but look for God's help to root out the sin behind the sin. And the further you travel along the road, the more of your sin that you'll see. So you'll never get past the need to grieve, mourn and wail for your sin. And then as we close, verses 11 and 12 give an example of what this will look like in practice. James started this chapter by talking about fights and quarrels. And now he comes back to this theme. And he shows that if you've truly humbled yourself before God, then fights and quarrels will become less and less of an issue. Because to speak against your brother is to say that you know better than God's law, which tells you to love your neighbour as yourself. But if you've truly humbled yourself before Jesus, then you'll realize that he's the lawgiver and judge. But you, who are you? Says James. Maybe you've heard football fans chanting a "Who are you?" chant at famous members of the opposition team. Yes, they may be millionaires and A-list celebrities, but that means nothing when they're not on their own turf. Jesus says to us, "You're on my turf. I own it all. So humble yourself." And as you humble yourself, he will continue to exalt you. He will continue to give you more grace, and you will know more and more of Jesus. So to be a Christian is to be taken down before you're lifted up. And really, that's not that surprising, is it? Because after all, that's how it was with Jesus. But his coming down was very different from ours, because we start at the bottom anyway. But he started off at the very top. He was fully God from all eternity. But Philippians chapter 2 tells us that Jesus didn't think that this status was something to cling on to. Instead, he came all the way down from being worshipped by angels to live as a servant. Maybe there are some jobs that we think that, well, the recession would need to go on for another year or two before we would do them. But what Jesus did is on a completely different scale. Jesus lowered himself right the way down by taking on not just human flesh, but the stench of human sin. And he let himself be mocked and killed by those he had made, so that our lives would be more than about surface change, so that we could experience such an amazing, loving relationship with him, and that by his grace we would react by living lives of humility, knowing that one day, by his grace, he will lift us up to be with him forever. Amen.